be here for when your bill comes out, because I got other things. Thank you.
The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Senator Saxhawk, I know you're here, but we're going to have Senator Limmer go. He has to a commitment elsewhere. Thank you. Senator Limmer, Senate File 1242.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for accommodating my schedule. I appreciate that. Senate File 1242 is a bill requested by MNCOR, the prison industry's component of our correction system, and it addresses, in general, the concerns that were made by the legislative audit report recently. You may recall that the Office of the Legislative Auditor conducted a special review of MNCOR Industries in response to concern that included, among others, concerns about the questionable disposition of surplus property and the donations that MNCOR made to certain nonprofit organizations. Senate File 1242 was introduced in order to address these concerns in the Legislative Audit Report of July 2006. Before we go further, Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. As an author's amendment, I'd like to introduce at this time. That would be the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is an author's amendment to put the bill in the shape he desires it to be in. All those in favor of the A1 amendment say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes.
Madam Chair, the questions of surplus property, the disposition of surplus property, a Minnesota Correctional Education Foundation, and other provisions are going to be explained in more detail by Commissioner Dennis Benson of Minnesota Corrections Department. And I'd like to have him review the bill for the committee, and then we'll stand for questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Benson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Just very quickly on the amendment, basically what the amendment does is add the Department of Corrections to those agencies that are statutorily authorized to access workforce database of Department of Employee and Economic Development, DEED. We want to do this so we can get better information regarding offender employment history, who gets jobs, who doesn't, and analyze the effectiveness of our reentry program as we move forward. So that was a housekeeping piece of legislation that we believe is very germane to this piece of legislation, and we'd ask that that be added or incorporated into the bill. I'm going to go through the bill here very quickly, and as Senator Limmer indicated, this is kind of a compilation of a response to the legislative auditor's report. We have moved MNCOR prison industry from a subsidized program to a break-even business-like program. Years ago, it was decentralized. It's now a centralized entity, and the statutory language just needed to be cleaned up and address the situation that occurs today in prison industry. So you've got a couple of handouts. The one handout that I would ask you to refer to is the one titled CCA Financial Status Reports and MNCOR Industries. And on the back of that, if you want to follow along, we can quickly go through the various revisions in a couple of different statutes here. First one is 16A-.72, and I would also add that we work very closely with the Department of Administration on some of these provisions and upgrades to the statutory language, as many of these, or a couple of them anyway, do pertain to the Department of Administration. Under subdivision 7 and 8 on page 2 of the bill, basically what we're doing here is adding language that clarifies that canteen funds, which is the store within the prison, various prison system, those funds and profits go into the MNCOR revolving account. heretofore, each institution used to have their own canteen fund, but now it's been centralized, so this just reflects what is practice today. Under 16B.181, subdivision 2B, D, and E, we talk about a couple of different things, but basically it speaks to the elimination of the state use mandate. It takes the Commissioner of Administration out of the picture at this point. We used to have a task force, or I believe it was a task force, that met frequently, and they developed performance measures and goals to maximize MA program and participation. But that state use law is no longer being used. We haven't used it for about 4 years, and it eliminates the requirement that state agencies must purchase from MNCOR. And then further on page 3, we strike the state use language. And then again on page 3, 16C.23, subdivision 2, surplus property. This was a point that was brought up in the legislative auditor's report, how we dispose of surplus property. Some of you might recall that we even unfortunately made the news on this issue, and that we sold some farm machinery parts that were not consistent with the statutory requirements laid out by Department of Administration. And again, what we're trying to do here is differentiate between surplus product and surplus property. Certainly, we should dispose of surplus property the way that every other state agency does, but surplus products, a little bit different. We have to get rid of our inventory, whether work in process or completed work, in a timely manner, so that this subdivision cleans that up and clearly identifies what property is and is not. Then moving down to 241.27, subdivision 1 and 2. Basically, this is cleanup language here that substitutes educational for vocational. The industry no longer uses the term vocational, so we refer to it all as educational. And it also clearly defines how MNCOR funds may be used. Basically, we say that can be used for inmate education, training, work skills development, and then certainly reentry. Going to page 4 of the bill, 241.27 subdivision 2, again, speaks to the issue of purchase of, we add services to materials, commodities, and then also clarify used in and held for resale. We go then to page 5 of the bill, 241.27 subdivision 3 and 4. And this section basically explains the disbursement of MNCOR funds, and it also defines what we believe that we have to have in our revolving fund at any given time to operate the business. Basically, we think we need 6 months of receipts, or at least what it took to run the business in the previous 6 months, and we average that according to the previous year. So we need 6 months' worth of dollars to keep the money moving, or keep the business moving forward in the event of an economic downturn, or sales are flat, as they have been from time to time in the past. This section further defines if we do run into trouble, the fact that we can, the commissioner does have the authority to borrow money to the revolving fund, but again, dollars not to exceed what it would take to operate the business for 6 months. And then we go to 241.278, Basically, what we're accomplishing here is getting the authority, statutory authority, to enter into working agreements with county facilities. We've had to do that a time or two where we don't have enough offenders to provide work in a specific shop, so we've farmed some of this work out to one of the local county facilities. This just clears up how those receipts get back into the MnCorp revolving fund, and that again is on page 6.
Oh, excuse me.
And at 241.278, it would be lines 6.16 through 6.24. At the bottom of page 6, 401.15, this again is some cleanup language regarding the Community Corrections Act counties. Basically, existing statutory language requires CCA counties to submit financial status reports on or before the end of each calendar quarter. That time frame is not sufficient for counties, so we change that to within 60 days of the end of the quarter. Again, that's a technical change to the bill. So with that, Madam Chair and members, if you go to the back page, speaks to the repealers. The first one, 241.021, speaks to sales to the Department of Administration. And again, this is language that is part and parcel to the state use law, no longer necessary, so we are simply striking that or repealing that or suggesting that it be repealed. And then the last one there, 241.85, this is old language that we haven't done since the before the turn of the century. It was a report that was required at one time that we haven't been doing since. So we're asking that that be repealed as well.
Commissioner, I know you've spoken briefly to the A1 amendment. Could you go back to that and just repeat the information with respect to the A1 amendment? It just asks for the Department of Corrections for the purpose of the post-confinement employment tracking to do something with the data. Could you talk a little bit about the context of that?
Madam Chair and members, as you know, one of the department's initiatives now is reentry and reentry programming. And as you also know, we're always under scrutiny in terms of outcomes, how well are we doing. One of the things that we're trying to do, not only in Prison MnCorp, but part of our reentry initiative, is to place offenders, to train offenders and place them in a job, in a facility, and then also place them in a job when they get out into the community. And we simply want access to that database so that we can determine how well we're doing with respect to inmate placement. We want to follow up into the community to see if, in fact, the offenders that we placed 2 years ago are still employed, what kind of a job do they have, so that we can come back before this committee at some future date and hopefully share good results with the committee. Again, we have talked to Deed about this. They have no problem. If you look at the amendment on page 2, actually it starts on page 1, there's quite a laundry list of entities and agencies that can already access this information. We're just asking to be number 13 there in terms of who can get access to the data. So that's kind of the crux of the amendment. I'd also mention that we have talked to Senator Metzen, who indicates he does not need to hear this, but on the other hand, I believe Senator Rest wants to hear the bill tomorrow, my understanding.
That's right. That's our understanding, too, Commissioner. Any questions for Senator Limmer or Commissioner Benson? I think that we've heard testimony when we had the department come in to talk to us about MNCOR and the legislative auditor's report, and this is just a follow-up to some of those departmental responses to the MNCOR report. None. Is anybody in the audience want to testify either for or against this bill? Senator Limmer, what is your wish?
Well, Madam Chair, I wish to move Senate File Number 1242 as amended. What is the title of Senator Rest Committee?
Be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
On Senator Limmer's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Sachs-Hogg. Senate File 1119.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 1119 is the annual DNR Omnibus Lands Bill. With me today is Kathy Lewis from the DNR Lands and Minerals Division to go over Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill and answer any questions the committee might have.
Very good. Ms. Lewis, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kathy Lewis with the Division of Lands and Minerals, DNR. The particular focus for your committee is probably Section 2 of the bill. I'll touch on Sections 1 and 3 also. Section 1 of the bill concerns the appraisal process that the DNR uses for acquisition of land. And we've been using an alternative valuation process. It's more like an abbreviated appraisal for lower valuations of land, and we're asking to increase the value. And you don't see before you 84.0272 subdivision 4, because that's not being amended, but that provides that the landowner must agree to this alternative appraisal method. Section 2 of the bill is concerning the process for the DNR acquiring land and working with the landowner. 84.0274 is what's called the Landowner's Bill of Rights, and the DNR buys from willing sellers. And this law was enacted back in 1980 that provided how the DNR must work with the landowners, be fair and open with the landowners, provide them information, identify their rights for them. And one of the provisions in the Landowner Bill of Rights is that we provide the appraised value information to the landowner at the time we're negotiating. It was identified last year as we were working on this issue that there's another state law in the Minnesota Data Practices Act that says appraisal data is protected non-public until the parties enter into agreement to buy the property. And we have protected that data until that point for other people inquiring about it, but we have been sharing the appraisal data with the landowner as required under the Landowner Bill of Rights. And so what we're doing here is identifying that the specific law will control when we're dealing with landowners who are willingly selling the property to the DNR. We would be continuing our practice to share the appraised value with the landowner. And Section 3 of the bill concerns a severed mineral interest law, and this requires landowners to file a severed mineral interest statement with a county recorder and pay an annual tax. And we've had a court case in St. Louis County in the past year, and the Court of Appeals identified a statutory ambiguity, and the proper place to resolve a statutory ambiguity is the legislature. And what we're doing is identifying some terminology that probably should have been removed when the bill was amended several years ago. And all we're doing is requiring that when a landowner of a severed mineral interest transfers it, they're required to file another statement. And the court said there's an ambiguity if forfeiture occurs if they don't file that statement. And what we're saying is the forfeiture would need to occur. That continues the enforcement practice that every severed mineral interest owner has to comply with. If you have any other questions on the bill, I'd be happy to answer them.
Ms. Lewis, the raising the amount on page 1 for the minimal value acquisition from $5,000 to $100,000 is pretty high. What's the rationale for that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was a process where for land acquisitions, we had started out with $5,000. For land sales, it was $50,000. It was law passed about 3 years ago. And we said, let's see how it works. And we've been doing $50,000 for land sales, and we found that what we're doing is we do a comparable sale analysis. We look at assessed value. We look at any recent sales. And we've also, on our land sales, compared it to actually paying for an appraisal being done. We find that the results are similar, but what we are finding is we're saving one-half to two-thirds of the cost of doing the evaluation, and we're reducing the time significantly. For lower value parcels, $100,000 is still pretty low for buying land, and we felt that that's a fair rate. The landowner has to agree to us to use this process.
I see. So it's an abbreviated appraisal as opposed to the cost of doing a full appraisal.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
And Ms. Lewis, and let's see, under Section 2, maybe you've already answered this, but I just want to make sure it's clear on the record. What we're asking in line 27 is basically, because I think the general law says that you don't have to show them the appraisal until there's an offer in the works. And what you're just asking here is to be able to tell the owners what the amount is even before an offer is made. And is that just a policy rationale to do that? And because in practice you're already doing that?
Madam Chair, you essentially have it. The since 1980, the Landowner Bill of Rights says that we provide the party we're negotiating with a resume of the appraisal, which includes the value information, and we've been doing that. But it was pointed out to us under the general law, the Data Practices Act, we can't provide that even to the landowner because it's protected non-public data, which means you can't even provide it to the subject of the data. And we worked through a discussion with the Department of Administration on the statutory canons of construction and said, well, which law came first in specific versus general? And we identified that we should clarify that we can continue our practice of being fair and open with the landowner and sharing them the appraised value. So we would have to not withstand the general law to continue to do that.
Good. Any questions for Ms. Lewis or Senator Sackhog? Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, can I ask a couple of questions about the part that's not before us?
Sure.
I used to be on the Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and so I've seen these kinds of bills before. And, you know, they're surplus land bordering public water and all of that. But I don't remember seeing sales of ConCon land before. And did I just forget that, or is this something different?
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do occasionally have sale of consolidated conservation area land. There's two types of sales in here. One is we're allowing the county to sell them. The counties would normally sell consolidated conservation land, but they only have authority under law if the land is classified as agricultural. So what we're doing is saying, in one case, the county can sell it if it wants to, notwithstanding the fact that it's not classified as agricultural. The other parcel is a 5-acre parcel of consolidated conservation land that we've had under lease. The last lessee was a concrete plant operator. We do have it under lease to a new concrete plant operator. It was not left in the best shape by the last lessee. And instead of going through cleanup and actions, the current lessee will take over responsibilities for the cleanup of the property, and we'll sell it to them at appraised value. And we felt that was a good resolution of solving the problem on the property.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, my last question was Section 29. Did this come from the department, or was this added in committee?
Ms. Lewis,
tax forfeited land for uses of tailings basin and buffer area.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this did not come from the department. This came from a separate bill. This is for the Minnesota Steel Industries project in northern Minnesota. And the county has authority to do 10-year leases for certain purposes, 15-year leases for stockpiling purposes and tailings basins, and County Board can set the term for easements, but under the project, Minnesota Steel Industries Financing Company is requesting a 20-year lease up front. And so that's giving the County Board expanded authority for the term of the lease, not beyond the normal leasing authority. And it was requested by the company through another legislative bill.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Saxhog. And I know that Senator Saxhog, whose district adjoins my district, is just as concerned as I am about a bill that might give the appearance to taxpayers that we're making it easier for a government agency to somehow take their land without fairly compensating them. So I just have a couple of concerns, and maybe I'm not understanding this correctly, but going back to the sections that you discussed and presented here that are, I think, within the jurisdiction of our committee, the change from $5,000 to $100,000 in terms of the value of the land, I know Senator Moi asked you a question about this, but when I'm looking at the language, it says you can make the determination for what you're going to pay based on and then it sets out four separate criteria, but it says or. So in other words, you could only have available, for example, one of those things, it seems to me, and that would be the only one if that was all that was available that you'd have to consider. And in that case, there is no requirement of an appraisal of any kind that I can see listed here. And in fact, you might just look at the assessed market value for tax purposes. And I know that in our area, there definitely are situations where the value of the land, especially if it's risen quite a bit in a recent in a brief period of time, the actual value of the land might be quite a bit higher than that. So, again, I'm just wondering if there's something I'm not understanding about that. And then the second thing that you talked about, where you talked about
Senator Olson, let's have her answer that.
Oh,
that's
okay.
A big question.
Okay.
And then we'll come back to your second question.
Okay.
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the acquisition process is willing sellers. We're not exercising condemnation authority. They can always, first off, remember, they can always walk away. They usually come to us saying they're willing to sell. What we're doing under this process is we do look at assessed value. Assessed value is not always the full answer to what the value of the property is. We look at always look at sale prices comparable in the area. You may not always have a sale of the property within the last year, and you often won't have an appraisal done on the property. You won't often have two and three there, but you might have those. We also can look at additional data. When you look at what an appraisal does, an appraisal looks at comparable sale data, and it also looks at the similar types of information. What's happened is under the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice, there's quite a bit of extra narrative reporting that's required to be done. And what this is getting back to is an abbreviated appraisal. And again, 84.0274, which you do not see in front of you because it's not being amended, requires the landowner to agree to us using this method. So the landowner can always walk away, and the landowner has to agree to us using their own method. And also the landowner has the right to obtain their own appraisal under 84.0274. They have the right to be reimbursed for the cost of that appraisal also. So they have several rights here to protect them, and it's a concern of us.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I definitely feel much better about it now that I understand that this isn't something that would be forced on a landowner. Then turning to my second question, which is on page 2, lines 28 through 30, the same lines that you've already presented. Again, maybe I just wasn't following you closely enough, but I didn't understand what the rationale would be for not allowing a landowner to have access to information that I think if they were going to want to dispute or address or really determine for themselves whether they think that the appraisal was fair or accurate, that they would want to have that information. And so just being informed of the value, unless there's something in that section you're referring to that lays out all those criteria anyway, I guess I wasn't clear.
Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. One of the things we're doing there is updating what an appraisal does. An appraisal gives you the value information. There's information in the appraisal that is public information, and what the landowner is now provided is a redacted appraisal that has everything but the value. So they are getting the acreage value and the building value. It's not something that they have to obtain through the appraisal. The appraisers were saying when the appraisal number gives them one number for land, they don't separate out timber and land. And so this is kind of doing, since this hadn't been updated for 2 to 3 decades, we wanted to reflect the current appraisal practice of what the number was that was reflected in an appraisal. That's all we were trying to do. The landowner certainly needs to have acreage number. That's something they look at, and they need to know values of buildings. That's something they certainly look at. We try to honor the, as best as we can, the being fair and open with the landowner, because we're trying to convince them to sell to the DNR, and they can walk away anytime they want.
Ms. Lewis, can you tell us what that cross-reference to Section 84.0272 is referring to?
Madam Chair, 84.0272 is part of what you see in Section 1. And under there's now several methods that the DNR can do for valuation. Under 84.0272, we can do an appraisal. We can do this minimal valuation. And there's also what you don't see before you is a trout stream easement formula that the legislature created. And so the minimal valuation and the trout stream easement formulas do not meet the official definition of an appraisal under the Uniform Appraisal Standards. And so we changed it to value as determined in those two in that particular statute.
So, Ms. Lewis, it isn't just a matter of saying to the landowner, you are informed. I mean, there's materials that have been produced under 84.0272 that you're cross-referencing that will be made available to the landowner in this instance if you're informing them ahead of time of what the dollar amount of that appraisal is. You will give them that information?
Yes, Madam Chair. We inform them under 84.0272 and under 84.0274. There's quite a bit of dialogue going back and forth.
Any other questions? Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, and I apologize because I came in after you'd begun describing this bill, but I would like to ask Senator Saxog, is surplus state land defined someplace? I don't see it in here where it's defined, and maybe it just has a meaning.
Ms. Lewis? Senator
Saxog? Madam Chair, yeah, I would defer to Ms. Lewis on this. Thank you.
Ms. Lewis?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a provision in Chapter 16B for surplus state land for certain state agencies. For DNR, it's in 94.09 and 94.10. And I don't think it is a definition, but it basically talks about the commissioners making determination that the land is no longer needed for ours would be natural resource management purposes. I think in 16B it says something no longer needed for state purposes. What the DNR is reviews the land and how it's being used and if it's needed any longer. So it goes through an extensive department review to say none of the divisions are using it, we're not managing it for a particular purpose, and it's no longer needed.
Madam Chair?
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, Ms. Lewis, do you know, is any of this land ever so-called public land that's not owned by a jurisdiction but belongs to the public, all of us?
Ms. Lewis?
Madam Chair, state-owned land is a lovely topic, and we do have a pamphlet that you can find on our website about public land ownership. There's a school trust land, there's university trust land. They're held in trust for the school to be used for the schools. Public accesses the land, conducts hunting on the land. We have land we acquire for forestry, land we acquire for parks, lands we acquire for fish and wildlife. It's owned by the state of Minnesota. Some lands are in trust for taxing districts. Some lands are in trust for other interests. Quite a bit of land is open for public use.
Madam Chair,
Madam Chair.
Senator
Madam Chair, I don't mean to belabor this. Senator Saxhog is giving me a smile because he knows what I'm talking about. I'm going to ask him a question later, but there is land called public land that is not within the jurisdiction or under the jurisdiction of the state or any governmental unit. It's deeded to the public for its use forever. It's so-called public land, and I don't think it's defined in statute. This happens to be riparian land, and it involves a current dispute in Aiken County and of people who live next to this land that's about 300 yards, I think, long on a lake. And it belongs literally to a guy from Texas or me or you or you. Because the deed says it was deeded to the public. And so it has created a really difficult situation for some people in Aiken County. So my question, Senator Saxhog, we aren't doing anything with that land in this bill, are we?
Senator Saxhog.
Senator Shea, definitely not.
Okay, thank you, Senator Saxhog. And someday I want to do something about that, but, you know, in the meantime, it just sits there as public land not owned by any government.
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, you and I together will do something.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ms. Lewis, on page 2, line 1, it says, in the event the value is less than $1,000, the commissioner may add a transaction incentive, provided that sum of the incentive plus the value of the land does not exceed $1,000. When in the world would anything be negotiated where it would, or how much land do you get for less than $1,000?
Madam Chair, we had a land exchange where we were having a little strip of land to a public access site that was $182. We had an appraisal in the last year that already had conservation easements on the property, and the appraiser said there's really no, and it had another restriction on the property, and the appraiser said really has no market value, that people wouldn't pay for it. And the idea here is the people have to spend time coming, you know, working with the deeds, getting, you know, their deeds together, the information together, working with us, and that in a few cases it's worth the effort to pay them a little bit for all the effort it is to transfer the title to the property. So it does happen on occasion to us.
Sure. The appraisal probably costs more than the value of the land itself. All right. Well, any other questions for Senator Saxhog or Ms. Lewis? Anybody in the audience who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1119 be recommended to pass and be.
Madam Chair, this should be the final stop. So we'd like to see it go to the floor.
Be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Sharon. Senator Sharon, welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Senate File 1336.
Yes, I am. Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Policy Committee, I'm here to present Senate File 1336. There is an amendment I'm hoping that someone will introduce.
Madam Chair, I move that amendment.
Senator Sharon, did this amendment come to us from somewhere else, or is this the first stop?
This is the first hearing.
Yes. Senator Ortman moves the A1 amendment, which is really the author's amendment, to put the bill in the shape that the author desires it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. This is a bill that asks for language change. It's considered technical change. The proposed legislation revises this statute and is needed to eliminate some confusion that may be caused by current statutory language regarding assessment and transfer of mentally ill offenders to the Department of Corrections Mental Health Unit at the Minnesota Correctional Facility that's called Oak Park Heights. The current statute uses, if you look at the statute, you can see where the line is crossed off on lines 1.8 and 1.12, that the words examine and examining in referring to mental health assessment process is the language that's creating the confusion. Those sections designate that the assessment process may be performed by licensed physicians and licensed mental health professionals. This language may be confused with the term examiner, and later on line 1.17 you'll see section 253B.07, which is a statute that refers to civil commitment process and defines examiner and narrows the examiner to persons who are doctorally prepared licensed psychologists, MDs, and advanced practice nurses certified in mental health. What this change in language does is broaden and allow for master's prepared psychologists, licensed social workers. It broadens the persons who are licensed yet but are able to assist in the process of transferring patients from the Minnesota Correctional from the Minnesota Correctional Unit to the mental health facility at Park Heights. And with that, I would like to offer some other testimony.
Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What Senator Sharon said is exactly correct. It's pretty technical in nature. There is a cross-reference to Statute 253B07, which is the civil commitment statute, which defines examiner in somewhat of those limiting terms. Given the diversity of our staff, we used licensed professional counselors, licensed independent clinical social workers. We have a variety of mental health professionals, mostly licensed in one way or another, who will be assessing, admitting, transferring, discharging to and from the mental health unit. And we just want to be able to allow those professionals to do so. So it's pretty technical in nature.
Ms. Larson, it's so the technical change is so minor that now I have questions. Okay, so what does this allow you to do that you currently can't do, and why do we need the change in the language?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. Right now, because of the reference to 253B07 and the definition of "quote unquote" examiner. In 253B, it only allows doctorally prepared licensed psychologists, MDs, and advanced practice nurses who are certified in mental health to assess, transfer, admit, and discharge to and from our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights. And it has, as I said, it has everything to do with the reference to 253B in our statute. We use a considerably larger group of mental health professionals now. Doctorally level prepared psychologists are not just the norm. We use master's level prepared psychologists. We use licensed independent clinical social workers. And what this change allows us to do is to have those professionals also be allowed to admit and discharge and assess to our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights. This has nothing to do with anything but our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights. Doesn't impact on DHS, doesn't impact on the civil commitment process, nothing. Just our unit at Oak Park Heights.
And Ms. Larson, let me ask you this. This also has no impact whatsoever on who does the treatment.
Madam Chair, it does not. That's correct.
Any other questions for Senator Sharon and Senator Higgins?
So, Ms. Larson, do I remember that if there's a person at one of the other correctional facilities, they would be sent to Oak Park Heights for medical care?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, that's correct. Our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights is a system-wide resource for our adult males.
Okay.
And so, yes, we do use it system-wide.
Mm-hmm. I'll move the bill, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 1336, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the floor. Is there anybody in the audience who would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, on Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Moving right along, Senator Foley.
Oh, you can be one on each side so I can just echo you both.
That's
Senator Foley, Senate File 1152. 57.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Delighted to be here and to bring forth Senate File 1157. I do have an amendment I want to offer, the A4 amendment.
And this is an author's amendment, right, Senator Foley?
It's also a technical amendment.
On the A4 amendment is the author's amendment to put the bill in the shape he wishes it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted.
And I also have the A3 amendment, which makes some small changes. It been distributed yet?
The A3 amendment, or the member's designee, I'm assuming that allows the legislative member or whoever it is to allow their designee to be in, Senator Foley?
That is correct, Madam Chair. What happens with the task force meetings is that times where I'm in session or I'm out of town or whatever, and the same with the House member, so other members on the same task force have the same right. And what that does is provide an opportunity for my designee to vote on the matters that are discussed there.
Good. Any questions to Senator Foley on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Senator Foley, on Senate File 1157 as amended.
The Madam Chair, do you want me to go through with the items in the Chris Turner's outline there?
Senator Foley, either you can go through it, or if this is a department bill, if the department is here, they could certainly speak to it. I think there are some areas we're expanding in some areas here, so I think that it would be good if somebody could from the department could maybe walk us through section by section of the bill, so that and then so members can ask questions as we get through.
Madam Chair, that's correct. I do have Deb Kirshner, who's the chair of the task force, and she'll start it out, and then we can proceed with Ms. Kotz.
Is it Ms. Kirshner? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Kirshner, and I'm the chair of the CRIMNET, or Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, and also a voting member on the policy group. And I would just like to briefly give you a small background on how we got to these four recommendations. In keeping with the statutory language in 299C65, each year both the task force and the policy group review possible legislative changes, basically because the statute asks us to ensure that criminal justice systems operate accurately and efficiently. So this year, as in past years, the task force basically created a subcommittee of its members to review possible items that might fall under this provision. That task force then made recommendations to the full task force, or that subcommittee made recommendations to the task force. And the four recommendations that you have before you today were brought forth first from the task force and approved there, and then brought to the policy group for discussion, and then approved there for your consideration.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dana Goetz, and I'm with the CrimNet Program Office at the BCA, and I'm just going to quickly highlight the five separate provisions in the bill. Section 1 expands the data subject access to the Integrated Search Service at the BCA, and the Integrated Search Service, or ISS, is basically a service that allows criminal justice professionals to access a number of statewide criminal justice information systems or repositories in one place. So when I go to Integrated Search Service, I could access information from the Predatory Offender Registry or the Repository of Arrest Photos or the Statewide Supervision System and other statewide systems. This language in particular allows a data subject to go to any agency that has access to the Integrated Search Service and request a list of government entities that have provided public or private data about that individual through ISS. So currently, an individual would literally have to go to each agency in Minnesota, approximately 1,100, to see public or private data on that individual. So this language would greatly or significantly improve the access for data subjects.
Section Ms. Goetz, let me ask you.
Sure.
Under this provision, if I went to one agency, then I would be able to, from the information from that agency, be able to identify which other agencies has my information?
Correct.
Very good.
Section 2 expands the accessibility of the driver's license photo to all criminal justice agencies, including public defenders, for specific purposes outlined in Section 2. Currently, only law enforcement have access to driver's license photos for the investigation and prosecution of crimes. So this language would improve the accuracy of identifying individuals throughout the criminal justice process, not just for investigative purposes. Section 3 would authorize the Department of Public Safety to establish a secure subscription service for criminal justice agencies. And what this is, it's not a separate system or service. It's basically a functionality that could be added to the Integrated Search Service, and it's just an ongoing automatic notification of an individual's interaction with other criminal justice agencies. So, for example, if I'm a probation officer, I could subscribe my client list, and then I would automatically be notified if someone on my caseload was picked up in another county or had some other interaction with a criminal justice agency. It would work much like the legislative subscription service, where people can automatically sign up to receive notices of committee hearings or status of bills, etc.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
So is this just an RSS feed? An RSS feed?
Ms. Goetz.
Never mind.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Was that an acronym, Senator Higgins?
It's the way in the Senate's website that you can get the data out of it.
Ms. Goetz, I'm trying to visualize how that would work. How do I subscribe to that? Like, if I have a list of people, presumably if something happens, it would somehow connect with the database that I have, and then it would flag that and send me an email. So is there something in the programming or the way the program is written that it will check through all these different shelves?
Correct. And I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with technically how it would work, but basically you could subscribe to, you know, certain individuals' names, and then you would automatically be notified, you know, through the system if there was some interaction with another criminal justice agency. Beyond that, if you have further questions, I could find out the information for you. But
yeah, I'm struggling to visualize the mechanics of how that works. But why don't you continue, and maybe somebody.
Okay. Section 4 revises the current task force membership, and these are basically technical changes recommended by the task force. Most constituencies on the task force, as Ms. Kirshner indicated, have two members. There's two sheriffs, two probation officers, two judges, and this language would allow the appointing association to still appoint two members, but only one of the members would have to be an actual sheriff or judge, and this would just allow more flexibility for the associations to appoint whoever they felt was most appropriate to represent their interests on the task force. And then finally, Section 5 is just a technical change to clarify the match requirement for locals who are recipients of CRIMNET grants.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Before you get to questions, I, on behalf of Mr. Neumeister, want to look on page 2, line 32 and 33. And you'll notice there's strikeovers to delete various languages. That's language that we put in the last session, and I'd like to keep that language.
Madam Chair,
Senator Scheid, Senator Scheid.
Yes. Madam Chair, we took out the existing Section 3. Does the language of the amendment?
Right.
This is what he wants. But we took that out.
I think the author's amendment?
The A4 amendment said page 2, delete section 3, and insert. And then there's language, but it's all new language until you get to the other side. I just wondered if that's what you were doing there. Is that, does that accomplish it, and we've already done it?
Mr. Backus?
Madam Chair and Senator Scheid, the amendment is purely technical. It deletes the current Section 3, reinserts it with technical changes. So Senator Foley's concern would still be there.
Yeah. So, okay. That's what I wanted.
Ms. Goltz, can you explain to us the rationale for changing direction of what current law is?
Madam Chair and members, this actually was not from the Bureau itself. It came, as Ms. Kirshner indicated, from the legislative delivery team of the task force. And I think their thinking was they preferred that the task force and policy group have the flexibility to move ahead with a subscription service and not necessarily be, you know, caught up in a legislative session that something might not get through, or that when the BCA was maybe ready to do it that they wouldn't have to wait for a legislative session. I think just more for flexibility.
Chair. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, aren't we giving them the legislative authorization through this section?
Mm-hmm.
So why do we even need this sentence? We're giving them the permission to establish the secure subscription service, unless I misread it, which I often do.
Ms. Goltz, currently there is no subscription service?
Madam Chair, members, there is not a subscription service for the integrated search service, but if you look on page 3 in Clause E, last year there was language that was adopted that allowed a subscription service for tactical to promote and enhance officer safety during tactical operations. So that is a separate subscription service. And I think Ms. Kirshner wants to chime in.
Madam Chair, as part of the discussion at the legislative delivery team that the task force had, and also at the task force, one of the reasons for allowing a slight expansion of the subscription was because of the inclusion of PRINs A and B, which very stringently restricts what a subscription service could be on, and that would be only on those situations where there's an active criminal case or investigation. So law enforcement or probation officers couldn't do a subscription on a closed situation or on someone that wasn't actively under investigation in the criminal justice system. So given those very strict parameters under which a subscription service could be developed, the task force felt that it was important to allow a flexibility to create those subscriptions within those very strict parameters.
Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, maybe because I'm new to the committee, I don't understand this as well as some of the others, but What is the difference between the integrated search service established by this bill and a different kind of subscription service that's contemplated by this section?
Ms. Kushner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the integrated search service, which has already been created, is basically sort of the criminal justice version of Google. Basically, it allows a certified user who's already been verified as a criminal justice staff person in the state to search various criminal justice repositories with one search. So it's not a subscription. I have to physically choose to sign on and search on a case that I'm doing an investigation on. And then I would get responses back from the participating data sources that are a part of the integrated search, one of which is at the Department of Corrections, some of which are at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. But it's with one search, so that avoids me having to sign on to multiple systems when I'm trying to investigate a criminal case. The subscription service that's being requested for your consideration would allow me as a probation officer or as a prosecutor to say, I have this case under active investigation. I would like to tell the search service to notify me if they're arrested 300 miles away in another county, and that way I will be prompted before I go to court and make a recommendation, because I'll know now they're under probation now in another county that I didn't know about. They're under investigation, but only if those cases are active. It doesn't let me do a subscription if the case has been discharged and I just want to find out how they're doing later.
So, Ms. Kushner, typically how long would your subscription be in the system?
Well, and again, these have not yet been developed, but typically one would, if I'm a probation officer, as long as my case is active. So again, as a probation agent, I would know how long I'm supposed to supervise this person. Once that case is discharged, the subscription would no longer be active. Although I am assuming, again, it hasn't been implemented, that if I transfer that case for supervision to another probation officer, then my subscription would no longer be active, and whoever is currently supervising that offender would then perhaps want the notification. It doesn't require anyone to do that, but if I've got a large caseload of high-risk offenders, it would allow us to have a more expedited notification if they're misbehaving outside my jurisdiction.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
In conversations, especially with community members, it seems like there's always been an issue about somebody who was arrested for, pick a crime, and when they go to court, nobody knows what else they have in their history, where else they might have outstanding warrants or have been convicted of something or another. And this would be the answer to that problem if everybody was signed up. Is that right?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this would indeed be one useful tool that would hopefully minimize those types of situations.
Yeah. And then, Madam Chair, just so people know, the RSS feed, the reference that I made, on the Senate's website, you can do much the same thing on various issues that you're interested in. You can ask to be notified, for judiciary issues, crime prevention issues, correction issues, pick whatever set of issues that you're interested in. And then you get notified if there has been a bill that has moved in committee, if a bill has been, passed on the floor, if it's being heard, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of the wave of how internet interactivity is working these days, and I think this is a great thing. I did have a question, though, if we can move on from the ISS thing to the photos.
I have a follow up in this section. Just remind me to come back to you.
Okay,
Ms. Kushner, for the subscription service or for people who have access to the service, I see here that law enforcement is stricken and criminal justice agency is now inserted. Is that broadening the – is criminal justice agency a bigger category of people than law enforcement?
Madam Chair, yes, it is, and it is statutorily defined so that does allow people like probation officers or the prosecutors to have access. If we restrict it simply to law enforcement, then the wider yet still small criminal justice community that actually – conducts much of the investigation to present to court or to prosecute the individual would not have access to that particular subscription.
And then, Ms. Kirshner, would every probation officer, every public defender get granted some kind of password to have access then to the system?
Madam Chair, there is already a registration process that's defined by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and it's a very stringent process to gain access to the Integrated Search Service. So it is restricted already to criminal justice agencies and public defenders as defined in statute. And there is an agreement already in place that requires an agency to participate and agree to abide by data practice rules and all of the regulations. It's also restricted to access over the secure criminal justice data network so that it identifies exactly what computer you sign on, what your user account is. So there is already a registration process in place, and this would simply allow the ability to develop something to expand on access to that service.
And do users have to use a specific kind of computers at your facilities, or can they? Is this web-based where they can sit at their office on, you know, University and Snelling and be able to do this?
Madam Chair, it is web-based. However, as I mentioned, it is restricted based on an IP address, based on a user account, based on being your agency already having access to the secure data network. So it's not like I can go to the library and sign on, even though I have an account with the Integrated Search Service.
And then you talk about an authorized data subject, and that seems a little bit odd to me, an authorized data subject, as if like someone else has sort of anointed them as the data subject. Can you explain that?
Madam Chair, this was our attempt at trying to wordsmith a way to identify the fact that the subject has to be under an active investigation.
And Madam Chair, this was language that was suggested by the Information Policy Analysis Division, IPAD, within the Department of Administration as kind of the experts on Chapter 13. They recommended that language to us.
I mean, I think identify data subject seems, or, you know, authorized seem to imply that somebody gave them permission to do something. I think this is being done unto them.
Madam Chair, it's typically a result of something they did to society.
I think they're alleged to have done. Yeah, they're still in the alleged part. You're right. Yeah.
Well, no, it's true. The suspects.
It's true. I mean, I'm concerned about that.
What line are you looking at, Senator?
I'm sorry. It's on page 2, line 22. That's the definition. And then it gets used, you know, down below on line 230.
Madam Chair? It's in the amendment, but it's
different than the amendment. That's okay.
It's defined there. You're right. Okay. I see.
Madam Chair?
Different page lines, but
do you think substituting the word identified for the word authorized would be a more accurate reflection of?
Is that going to mess you guys up, Ms. Goltz and Ms. Kirshner?
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley?
Can you provide these ladies the copies of the amendments?
Can I get a copy of the amendments?
Subject of the data search, possibly. I'm just track anybody if you want to.
I would recommend Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to interrupt your line of thinking here, but I'm concerned about the A4 amendment and paragraph 3. The subscription service means a process by which you can obtain contacts, notice of any contacts the authorized data subject has with any criminal justice agency. That could be me calling because my daughter is missing or because I'm getting prank phone calls. It could be any contact. It could be a stop where there's no reason to stop me, and they let me go. That could be, it's very broad to say any kind of a contact, and we know that in Minneapolis they've actually done some stop and release people, you know, where they stop people, they arrest them, but they release them, and I just think this is very broad, and I'm concerned about the process here. I heard Senator Foley say this came from a delivery team from the task force, and there's an awful lot of hierarchical government in CrimNet, as we all know, so I'm wondering, what about the other levels of government? Are they supportive, the criminal justice advisory group? Are they supportive of all the provisions in this as well? Have they passed it and made a recommendation to us?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, yes, the task force and the policy group did approve these recommended changes after discussion. And just one clarifying, yes, in Section C, it is any contact. However, it's based on the fact that the subject is already, whatever we decide to call them, authorized or identified, is already a part of an active criminal investigation. So you would not be able to do it on anyone, you would have to do it on someone that you are already actively involved in either a court case or an investigation of a criminal activity.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Can I just ask a couple more questions? Would that be all right? What about the audit trail? At some point there was the determination that CrimNet would try and do audit trails so that if somebody was following somebody and doing these searches with their password, that the ultimate supervisor of their department would have some kind of audit trail to show who's been on CrimNet, who they've been following or checking or searching. Is that going to be available with this?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, there is an audit trail with integrated search currently.
And Madam Chair, can you just tell us who would be receiving the audit trail information with the responsibility to check that the people they supervise aren't using this tool improperly?
Ms. Kushner?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, currently, as for example, the integrated search user administrator for my department, I am the one who's authorized to request the audit trail. And so it's not just any user within my agency who can request it, but it is those who have been identified as sort of the user administrator for the agency. That does not mean that as subscription services are potentially developed, should this pass, that wouldn't be either expanded or changed. The audit process is already there. It does identify who signs on, what services they participate in, and currently user administrators then have the ability to request that information.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, and then just going forward, from what I'm understanding, the way the bill is drafted, it sounds like you don't actually have the search service yet. You want to create a search service. Am I reading it right? Because unless this bill passes, you don't have the authorization to do it. So I'm thinking that you're asking for the authorization because you haven't done it yet, and now you want to. Am I right about that?
Ms. Kushner?
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, the search service the integrated search is built. It's requesting authorization should subscription services be identified as wanting to be created. Currently there is already an integrated search service where authorized users can sign on and see if someone is in prison, for example, or in jail. This is a request, excuse me, to say I want to be notified automatically if they're booked in jail in another county that I'm not supervising them in. It's sort of the difference between proactive and me having to physically sign on. This would allow me to sign on and request being notified without going and looking for it if my huge caseload, several of them, come in contact with law enforcement.
Ms. Goetz?
I was just going to add that for those of you who have been around, the integrated search service is what some commonly referred to in earlier years as the CrimNet backbone or kind of that underlying linking of all the different systems together. And the subscription service would just be adding an additional functionality to that service.
But Ms. Kushner, though, looking at the language on line 222 to 224, For the purpose of this section, in your language, an authorized data subject means an individual who is the subject of an active criminal investigation. So they're not sitting in prison or out on probation. A criminal charging process or open case in criminal court, probation, or corrections. What you've been talking about are those who are part of corrections and probation, or perhaps an open case in criminal court. But an active criminal investigation is somebody who doesn't belong to all of that, all those categories. So if I was a prosecutor and I have a case before me, I could, in essence, put that person's name into subscription to see in the time when this the paperwork has commenced until when the trial starts what other troubles they get into. Is that not true?
Madam Chair, yes, that is true. However, the end of the section does talk about an open case in court, probation, or corrections. And so that's maybe our technical language, but when we are in probation and are supervising an offender, we call that an open case. So if I have a caseload of 50 open probation cases, then I would be able to use this service to say, tell me, have any of them been involved in the criminal justice system elsewhere in the state. So it is more than just an active investigation. It's also an open probation supervision case, an open prison case who's out on supervised release.
I understand that. I think what is of concern to members, some members of this committee, is that as is an active criminal investigation. I mean, this person hasn't been convicted. This person hasn't even gone to court yet. I mean, we're still in the active investigation stage. And a police officer or, you know, a prosecutor could go in and subscribe to this individual. Or in that subscription, put in, you know, John Smith. What other identifiers are being asked when people subscribe to make sure that the John Smith that gets a hit, particularly in active criminal investigation cases, are really the John Smith that the person is subscribing to? Ms. Kirshner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this point, none of those have been specifically defined as what other identifiers. This is just request for authorization to design such a process.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, on that, it's more than that. It's even just contacts. That person might not even be in trouble, but happens to have a contact with someone, and that even broadens it further. And the authority that's being requested here is to establish the subscription. It's not to propose the subscription service. It is to establish it. And if we grant this, they're going to go back to work on this. And I'm wondering, if you need functionality, are there some kind of parameters that you're proposing? And if so, are there also costs that go along with establishing this? And has there been a fiscal note requested?
Senator Ortman, Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, no, again, this was an idea brought forward by the task force, thinking that this is a good tool, as Ms. Kirshner identified it, for law enforcement and other criminal justice agencies that they would like to pursue. But the language says that DPS may establish, so we have not committed to establishing anything, we have not got beyond any type of or gone forth with any design or anything further than just the idea of what it could look like.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Ms. Goetz, in all of the proposals that we had for funding $16.5 million worth of CRIMNET this year, is the funding for this in that money?
Ms. Goetz? Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, no, it is not.
My sense, Ms. Goetz and Ms. Kirshner, is that the subscription service, the authorization to go ahead and develop that, I think it's problematic for this committee to statutorily authorize that when we don't have, when we still have some questions about how it would be implemented. And I understand that you need the authorization to go ahead and do that. But I think what you're hearing, maybe not from Senator Higgins, but at least from this chair, is that I have some reservations about authorizing you to go forward until we see a little bit more detail. I'm of the mind that I would like the group to do a little bit more thinking and asking some of these questions that we've asked to see if it is proper to make it available in active criminal investigations. I'm perfectly okay for a probation officer who needs the tools to help him or her as they're trying to track their caseload. But I'm a little bit queasy on making this available for active, for criminal investigations that hasn't really reached a particular end yet. So, Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, for the purpose of moving this forward, why I'd move that we strike Section 3.
And Senator Foley, I understand from Mr. Backus that we could do it from the amendment, and that would address that concern. So, Mr. Backus, perhaps you could help us walk through.
Madam Chair, if Senator Foley's motion would simply be on the A4 amendment to delete Section 3.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I think this could be one of the great tools that we could give people to have this sort of service. So if you, if you had an active criminal investigation going about Senator Olson, you could check to see.
Why are you picking on Senator Olson?
Because she's to my right. That's the only reason. But, it would be the way that you could find out whether there was an outstanding warrant. It would be the way that you could find out, all that other information that I think would be really relevant to putting your case together for somebody. And, the hoops that I think, if I'm correct, that people have to go through to get that information now is really a barrier to, good criminal investigating. And I'm going to oppose taking it out of here because I think this is a great idea.
Well, Senator Higgins, I don't think the committee is saying that it's not a good idea. I think Senator Ortman and I are of the mind, especially after the work we've done on sealing of arrest records and expungements, that we'd like there to be some thought given to this. I'm not opposed to giving law enforcement tools to do what they need to do, but I think there's some questions that we should just think about before we give the authorization. And I would hope that that it's taken in that vein and that we're not hostile to the idea, but we would like some more thinking on it to come back to us to show. And I think that Senator Ortman or I would be more than willing to, sit down and talk with you about what some of our questions are and some of our concerns are, so that as you take it back to the task force or the working group, you could build in some of those questions into how we would implement a subscription service like this. I think, Senator Higgins, once the integrated service search is in play, if somebody shows up in court, the court would have access to something like that, and they can do an inquiry under the individual's name. And anything else that has surfaced or is in any other area, I would think they would get a hit.
But, Madam Chair, the difference is you can do it in one search here, where now you'd have to go to every different jurisdiction, every different state, or you don't get all the information in one place, unless I'm mistaken.
Ms. Kirshner, by eliminating the subscription service, we're not eliminating the integrated search service that's already in place, right?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So, Senator Higgins, I think your concern has been addressed. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, just to address what Senator Higgins was saying, I think the only thing we're eliminating here is a reminder that would come up automatically. But I can see definitely the benefit for that, because knowing how busy prosecutors' cases are sometimes and how going back and going through an extra step would sometimes cause some things to fall between the cracks, I would just say that I am generally in support of this concept, and I would vote in favor of it if I didn't think it would come back with some tighter language. But I would echo Senator Ortman's concern that the word contact, That's my only objection to it, is just that we might want to be more limiting, from my perspective anyway, of it being some type of criminal contact or some type of contact that would give you a reason for some concern.
Well, members, we'll see this again. On Senator Ortman's motion, on Senator Foley's motion.
Madam Chair, before we do that, I'd like to add an additional witness here who is also a member of the task force.
Pull the mic close.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer. I work for the Board of Public Defense, and I've worked on the task force for the last 10 years. I agree with concerns about the subscription service. It definitely does add risk. Any time you expand accessibility to such a vast collection of databases, you also expand the possibilities for abuse. When the idea was first proposed, my concern arose about the accuracy of the underlying data. I'm particularly concerned because I see court clerks as being the lowest paid people in the system, and they're under the highest pressure, and they're doing their best, if you sit in a criminal courtroom and watch them, to enter data as fast as they can. And there's no real check on the accuracy of the data. So that caused me great concern. It was in response to that concern that I really proposed and stood behind the discussion about increased data subject access, which is the whole integrated search discussion that you have been having. If we're going to advance the system to include subscription, we're increasing risks. We should concomitantly increase the protections by allowing an individual to view their own record and make a complaint under the existing data practices provisions about any inaccuracies in that data. So the two concepts, to be fair to the task force process, the two concepts really have been bound from the beginning, that if we're going to increase the use, and we're going to increase the risk, we're going to increase the potential for abuse, we also should increase the protections. So in my mind, the two have been bound, one increased risk, one increased protection.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sikora, for your testimony. I, for one, like the increased protection, but I don't think we're ready yet for the increased risk. Senator Foley, have you changed your mind about your motion?
No, Madam Chair. I call a question, I guess.
On Senator Foley's motion, and the question, Senator Foley has called a question. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion is adopted.
Now, Madam Chair, can I ask my question about the photos?
Yes.
In Section 2, where we talk about who can get the driver's license photos, we're adding a long list of people in the criminal justice agencies. And I wanted to call your attention back to our discussion with Senator Bonoff's bill, where we talked about the court administrators or the court, somebody in the court system, putting together the order for protection or the whatever that thing was called.
The no contact order.
The no contact order. And putting a photo into that. And I guess I don't know whether those folks would be in the new language from 2.13 to 2.16, but I think they should be. Or someplace in there.
Senator Higgins, at that time, we did not have this bill in front of us.
Yeah.
And now that we have this bill in front of us, I think it's the appropriate question to ask. And unfortunately, I think that night the BCA wasn't here. Otherwise, I think they would have been able to answer the question. So, Ms. Kirshner and Ms. Goetz, the question is... how accessible is this information if this does become law? Would it be, how accessible is it to the courts for purposes of getting a photo, the driver's license photo of somebody who might be in front of the court?
Madam Chair and members, the courts would be included. They would have access to the DL photos, whether... You know, I couldn't speak to their process of, you know, how they would actually get those photos to be on the no contact orders related to Senator Bonoff's bill, but they would have access to the DL photos under this language.
And then Ms. Goetz and Ms. Kirshner, was there any discussion if we were to expand this about a concern for consent on the part of people when they go to take their get their driver's license and have their photo taken, that maybe we ought to alert people that this is going to be used for other purposes other than on your driver's license?
Madam Ms. Chair Goetz. And members, no, that didn't come up in the discussion at all.
I know that currently some of that, under current law, explain to the committee who has access to the driver's license photos.
Madam Chair and members, currently law enforcement has access to the driver's license photo for the prosecution and investigation of crimes.
And the new language then, what would that do? Ms. Goetz.
Madam Chair and members, it would expand the accessibility to all criminal justice agencies and then expand also the purposes which are listed in Section 2 there.
Yeah, I mean, I just, I don't know what the rest of the committee members think, that I have some.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Kirshner.
Just to give the committee some of the rationale behind this, as most of you are probably aware, identification is a critical issue at all aspects of the public, of criminal justice investigation, and Mr. Sikora can speak well also to this. But one of the concerns is right now, and I'll give my my typical probation example, is to ensure that we are that the person who shows up and says that they're ready to be supervised is indeed the person that has been convicted of the offense, and identification by photo is one of the critical measures on which we would like to be able to use.
Mrs. Sikora.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. These photographs are already available on paper. Our public defenders, if they have to serve somebody with a subpoena, they're going into a neighborhood to serve a witness with a subpoena, they like to know who they're trying to serve. Or a law clerk investigator going out to interview someone, they take a paper subpoena to the East Maryland office of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, wait a day or two, and in response to their paper subpoena, get a copy of the person's driver's license photo, so when they're going out to interview or serve a subpoena, they have that photograph. What this bill does is it advances the law to accommodate the reality that this information is now available electronically. So they would be subject, as you know, all of our employees are state employees subject to discipline and subject to our regulations. They're subject also to audit by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They already are in getting criminal conviction histories that are not public. So this would put them on that list for an audit so that they are guaranteed to be using it according to statute. And the change would be, instead of having to take a drive to the BCA office to serve a paper subpoena to get these data, they would get them electronically.
I understand that as the current practice, Mrs. Sikora. But as the policy committee and as we're contemplating sort of the direction that we want to go, if it is as a matter of accommodating current practices or to expedite or to, you know, make sure that the process that we're doing works, and if it is a matter of public policy where we see this as a value to expand or to allow law enforcement agencies or criminal justice agencies to have access, then I just think that at some point we need to put the public on notice that, you know, when you go down to the Department of Motor Vehicle Services and you get that nice headshot of yourself that goes on your driver's license, you're giving permission for that photo to go into a database that will be used by many, many people for many, many other purposes other than going on your driver's license. I'm not saying that it shouldn't be done. I think that we need to have a discussion about that in this committee, and I'm suspecting that this bill is probably going to go to transportation, and I hope that, you know, if we can't engage in that discussion here, I would hope that there will be a robust discussion in that committee, because I'm just I think that if we think that from a public safety standpoint it's of value to allow that expansion to take place, then we better also think about how to fully inform the public of what they're letting themselves get into. I don't know what the rest of the other members of the committee thinks of that. But,
Madam Chair, I think the issue is so much broader than what you've enunciated. That you look up there behind you, and there's a camera there, and a lot of the time that is going through Channel 17 or some other broadcast entity. You go down the streets in the north side by Senator Higgins' places, and there are all kinds of cameras
not
down
yet.
There. And or they're going to put them in, and the same as downtown. I think we've gotten to a point where we have to acknowledge that and make sure that we make it as safe as we have. That's why I applaud Mr. Sikora for doing what he's done, and I want you to know that Mr. Neumeister has been a diligent supporter of seeking ways to make this work better and to protect all of us from misuse of data. And I've been on this committee or task force for 10 years, and this has come a long ways, and there's an awful lot of work that has been done and an awful lot of work that needs to be done. But our efforts are just going to have to continue that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I share your concern. I think people at least ought to know. I mean, I think that we ought to talk about that. And I don't know that you want to do that right now.
I was the only one speaking. If members of this committee want to chime in, you know, please. If this committee doesn't address that issue, I will be putting my thinking cap on between here and transportation. And, if we think that this is good and we pass this out of here with this provision, I just think that we need to have that discussion about putting people on notice. Senator, we'll go with Senator Olson and then we'll come to you, Senator Altman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wouldn't have any objection to, and I don't know what possible real, unless it's just to increase paperwork or a cost, but I think that Senator Foley is correct. There's a broader issue here because whether it's driver's license or photographs we take for other purposes or not just photographs but information in general, I think the only way to really address that might be in a broader way than just this bill to say something about whenever as a government entity we are requiring or obtaining information that we're putting someone on notice with maybe some type of a signed statement or something that they realize the purpose of it is more than just a limited purpose and it can be used in a broader context. And maybe we have to have a reference. But I don't know if it would be a good idea to just attach something like that to this bill or if we should be looking at that issue more broadly as it would apply to lots of different information obtained by government agencies.
Well, I think that's a broader issue, policy discussion that this committee will be engaging in as we move forward. I mean, we're seeing different policy areas kind of converging. You know, Senator Foley brought up the issue about the photo, the cameras here and the cameras, you know, on the cop cars and the cameras at the red lights if the bill passes and the cameras in the neighborhoods. Those are really have raised serious public policy implications. And I think that this committee will have an opportunity to talk about those issues. I mean, cameras and police cars for public safety of our officers, maybe an argument could be made for public safety. Cameras on stoplights and a cross section where, you know, it's for public safety, But once we start going down the route of putting cameras in neighborhoods, you start going, well, there's a certain realm of expectation of privacy that when I drive into my cul-de-sac that, you know, the big brother is not watching what we're riding around our tricycles around. I mean, there's certain lines where it starts to make people a little bit anxious, and I think that this committee will be engaging in that discussion. And whether we like it or not, I think at some point we're going to have to kind of draw the bright line, arbitrary as it is, in that conversation because it's coming here. I mean, it's on its way here. I think this is another issue that fits into that when you start thinking about it. Again, the trade-off is if we think that from a public safety standpoint, you know, we want to make that those images available, then I think that we ought to let the public know that when you go down and you give up that right to get your photo taken, so it goes on your driver's license for the privilege to drive in this state, that you're also signing away, giving explicit permission for the state to take that image and make that available to law enforcement agencies, you know, to use for whatever purpose, for you know, criminal justice purposes. And I think that that's a really big deal. And so I don't know if I can come up with an amendment for the time being, but Senator Foley, I'm going to be thinking about this and working with you, and I think that that's an area that I'm going to raise once this gets to transportation.
Madam Chair, if you look at the overall effort here, Ms. Gotz has already indicated a desire to help develop appropriate language. The task force itself has looked at this, and they've got subcommittees and so forth to help on that. And the effort is going on. The life is not such that we can just stop anymore. We've got to move forward. And I'm pleased with the efforts we've made in data security. It's just that that's an ongoing thing, and you just have to keep working at it.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would echo your sentiments. The balance here is really the tough one to come up with, because if it were a crime in my family against someone in my family, I would want law enforcement to have every last tool available to go find out what happened and to investigate. And so I would think that my thinking would be directed towards giving them every tool. And I wouldn't care about anybody else's privacy. If they had a driver's license with a photograph on it, from that point of view, I wouldn't care. On the other hand, however, I walk into a driver's license bureau, and to get my driver's license, I take a picture for the purpose of a driver's license. And so am I agreeing to so much more? As you've said, at a bare minimum, we've got to put a notice on the application and renewal application for driver's license in the state of Minnesota saying that your photograph and any information here can be used for purposes of criminal investigations and all these other things. But it seems to me that what's been missing in this room today is the public. I don't hear or see the public engaging in what seems to me momentous change in the law and the use of information. It's 4:45 on Tuesday night, and I don't believe that the public has been engaged to think that when they go and get their driver's license now they're going to be subject to criminal investigation, or that if they got a driver's license picture 4 years ago now that they are going to be subject to criminal investigation and those records are always going to be made available to all the people that might be authorized to do it. And so the minimum is let's put the notice on the driver's license. But we could go further, Senator Moy, and I would hope that we would, that the Department of Motor Vehicles would do one of their educational campaigns or somehow do some kind of engaging of the public to say, we're going to use these things in a whole different way now. Because I have a feeling that if we had this hearing again after we did that, there'd be a whole lot more people in this room having something to say, and my emails would be full.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Ortman. I just have to say that before I came to the legislature, I used to have a little bit more time in the evenings. I used to watch Law and Order quite a bit. And honestly, I think most in the public assumes that we already have a lot more access to technology and information than we actually do have. And that maybe what this bill is trying to do is give law enforcement the tools that we see in a kind of a sci-fi way in a lot of these programs. So I don't know if people would be as surprised, although I do share your concern, and I share Senator Moy's concern. But I wanted to go back to another thing that was raised by Senator Higgins earlier, and that was the bill that we heard presented by Senator who was it?
Bonoff.
Senator Bonoff. On line 2.19, I'm wondering if we could possibly insert language that would allow the court to attach, if we should just be more specific about making certain that they have access to copying and attaching these photographs to orders for protection and no contact orders. I don't know if we're going to be having a chance to hear Senator Bonhoeff's bill again, but if we were to insert language, it would at least make it consistent. And if we didn't hear Senator Bonhoeff's have time to hear it again, we might at least be.
Senator Olson, her bill was passed down and went to finance.
Oh, it was. I'm sorry. Okay, well, then I guess I misremembered that. So I guess the question would just be whether it's necessary then to have language in here that would make it more explicit.
Mr. Backus, under the language that is here and under the new permission, would the court be able to access the database to get a photo to, if the court has a process to do that, to put it on a no-contact order?
Madam Chair, members, as was testified earlier, I think courts would be within the definition of criminal justice agencies. But, I mean, to be extra sure, you might want to add something like issuance of orders for protection or no-contact orders, just to clarify that that would be the type of thing they could use it for, because you already say service of process, things like that. I think you probably want to be a little more specific there, just so they're clearly authorized.
So, Mr. Backus, could you come up with, should we do a new paragraph, subparagraph 5, or?
Right.
I see. All right. Ms. Backus, can you read to us Senator Olson's motion?
Madam Chair, members, after service of process, semicolon, insert issuance of orders for protection or no contact orders, semicolon.
Just to be sure we have it, Mr. Backus, can you repeat it one more time?
Yes, Madam Chair. After process, after that semicolon, insert on line 2.14, insert issuance of orders for protection or no contact orders, semicolon.
Senator Foley, is that agreeable
Very
to you?
Good.
All right. On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Any other questions for Senator Foley? Senator Foley, on Senate File 1157 as amended.
Madam Chair, I would recommend that Senate File 117 be recommended to pass and
be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. And then after that, I think it would then be referred to Transportation.
Well, that's a terrible place. I've never won a case in
Ms. Kirshner, before we vote, I did have a question that was raised, and maybe it's just a clarification. On page 1, line 22, it says data that describe what is maintained about the individual at each government entity on the list. It says data that describe. What does that mean?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was an attempt to clarify that you would know that it was a probation record about you or a jail record about you, as opposed to just knowing that Ramsey County had something, so that it would clarify which particular record type and what that information was, so that you would be able to be explicit if you wanted to make a request for a challenge or something with that agency.
So obviously the behind the scenes is that whoever is creating the data are putting in much more detailed information than just a very meaningless descriptor, but there will be more detailed information that will be get inputted.
Ms. Kushner?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, the Integrated Search Service has a great deal of detail. The intent of this was to let the individual, the subject of the data, be able to know that these particular agencies have information about them, and it's this type of record or this type of information that they have about the individual.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins.
Grammar Grinch for a minute.
Okay, Grammar. Senator Foley withdraws his motion. Senator Higgins.
I'd like to fix a misplaced modifier and delete on the end of line 1.18, delete the word only, and on 1.19, insert it after provide and before the colon.
On Senator Higgins' motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. We've done that on the title, Senate Council noticed that we already did that in the technical correction. Very good. Very good. Senator Foley renews his motion that or moves that Senate File 1157, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. Any further discussions? Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on the bill? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. The motion is adopted.
You got a wonderful name.
Hainsworth? And Ms. Timmons, you come to the table. Members, this is the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. It's passed through this committee once before. It actually, in previous sessions, had sat on the Senate floor in general orders. And I think the reason why it never became law was because there just was no movement with the companion. And so what I would like is to have, and this act has been worked over and over among all the different stakeholders. And so I would like to have Ms. Timmons and or Mr. Hainsworth go through the language with us. And as they go through it section by section, if you have any questions for them, please feel free to ask their questions. And then what we would like to do is, I believe there's an amendment. Where's the amendment? There's an amendment.
I have it right here.
Do you have the amendment?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to make sure the members have the amendments. Do the members have the amendment?
No. I don't think so, Madam Chair.
No, it should have been copied. It should have been copied, so we just want to make sure that all the members have the amendment. Okay, we don't have the amendment copied?
Oh, no.
All right. Well, as you go through the bill, Mr. Hainsworth and Ms. Timmons, why don't you just allude to the amendment, and when we actually have language in front of the committee members, we'll find someone to move it so we can adopt it.
All right. Thank you, Senator Mauer. If you don't mind, I think it would be easier if Ms. Timmons went through the act, because she was on the drafting committee and, as the reviser of statutes, has also been involved in the draft of the actual bill, which incorporates a number of amendments that were worked out with the environmental agency and the attorney for that agency, who's here today to also answer questions that may come up. And also the two amendments that you see that are the amendments for the sponsor have been worked out with both the real property law section and the Attorney General's office on behalf of the agency.
Where is the attorney for the agency?
It's Alan Williams.
Mr. Williams?
Yes.
Please go to the table, Mr. Williams, so you could be sitting there. Anyone else who is here to answer questions that should be at the table? Because as we're going through, the members might be asking questions, so I just want to make sure you're all sitting there, and then we can just have the questions answered. Very good. Ms. Timmons, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm Michelle Timmons, the reviser of statutes, and you may or may not know, I didn't know until I got the job of reviser that one of the jobs that came with it is that I serve as a commissioner on the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws with the unwieldy acronym of NCUSL. But it's proven to be just a really interesting job. And one of the drafting committees that I served on is this one for the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. And before I became reviser, I worked for Ramsey County for 18 years, and I had quite a bit of experience with environmental law. So I volunteered for this committee, and so I did serve on the drafting committee, and I can go through it with you. The first section, of course, is the title. I just want to tell you a little funny story about that. We had as an advisor a law professor who was just adamant that this act should be, that these really weren't covenants, that these were environmental servitudes. And so she wanted us to rename this the Uniform Environmental Servitude Act. And I said, what's one of my contributions on this national committee was to say, well, I didn't quite say, are you nuts? But I said, you know, enactability is really important. And I really think we should continue to call it the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. And that if we call it the Uniform Servitude Act, we are not going to get very many national enactments of this. So anyway, I evidently was persuasive in that. So we do have a title.
We have the amendment now in front of the committee members.
Good.
Do you all have the amendment? Senator Olson moves the A070173 amendment to put the bill in the shape that the author would like it to be in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Senator Higgins?
Can somebody tell me what an environmental covenant is?
That's what we will hear.
Okay.
Ms. Timmons?
Sure. I can answer that question, or Mr. Williams could. Essentially, when you have a contaminated property, sometimes you want to have a restriction on the use of that property. Sometimes you might want an affirmative obligation to continue to do a cleanup, aeration, or something like that. So an environmental covenant can be used for either of those, either a continuing cleanup or a restriction on use, something that furthers the environmental goals. Oftentimes that would be used short of a full-scale cleanup where you dig up all the dirt and put it somewhere else. So this act doesn't make any judgment at all about when those kinds of cleanups should be utilized, when you should have an environmental covenant and have the property sold to a third party with that covenant on it. What it does is provide a tool that hopefully, if it's passed by every state, would be uniform across the states. I don't know if Mr. Williams has anything to add.
Ms. Timmons, would this be something that, does it only deal with the land or could it deal with the buildings as well? What I'm thinking of are the meth labs and, the huge environmental cleanup that's involved when, you know, you shut down a meth lab and clean up the house or the building. And we've had lots of discussions over the years about whether these houses can be cleaned up well enough that another family could move into and live in safely. And then there's always the discussion of should there be some information on the title that stays with the title forever. And so does that connect with this at all?
If I might, Senator, to say this, it would have to be a determination, which would be not part of the covenant, that it could be used for something. The covenant would stay what it could be used for.
Okay.
And then that gets recorded. Whatever those restrictions are, those get recorded. So those are part of the public record of the title to that property. And they stay there. They run with the land. So whoever bought it would buy it subject to that.
So it is a covenant on the land.
It's a covenant on the land. But, of course, the use of the land, I mean, if it's not safe to have a building on it because of a contaminated building, then you couldn't use it. That would be a determination by the environmental agency. Alan, you might want to speak to that.
Members, let's do this. Let's hear the mechanics of the bill and what the covenants are used for and what it does and the interaction between the federal agencies and the state agencies and, you know, why we want to put this in place. And then once I think we understand that, then I think then we'll have a better context for asking more specific questions like yours, Senator Higgins. So, Ms. Timmons, can you walk us through the bill?
Yes, I can certainly do that, Madam Chair and members. The definitional section, there are a couple things I'd just like to point out. The activity and use limitations definition was taken out of federal law, other law dealing with environmental projects, because, again, the goal here was not to supplant the judgment of any of the environmental agencies. It was to give a tool to deal with contaminated real estate. So we didn't reinvent the wheel there. I think the definition of environmental response project is important because this applies to land where there is an environmental response project. In other words, there is some kind of contamination. There is a recognized project to deal with the brownfields. The other definition that I'd like to point out is that of holder. Well, I guess that's actually a cross-reference to another section. But we had a lot of discussion about the term holder of the covenant. The holder can be the pollution control agency, for example, if our state agency wanted to be the holder, and our state agency must sign off on these covenants, but the state agency does not need to be the holder. The holder can be a third party, such as a nonprofit, that might be created to deal with a particular piece of property or a more general nonprofit that deals with environmental problems. So I think those are some unique features in the definitional section. Section 3 really talks about how the environmental covenant is an interest in real property, and this is important because, as Professor Hainsworth said, it's something that needs to run with the land, stay with that land. Section 4 really talks about what must be in an environmental covenant, that it has to have a description of the property. It has to have a description of those activity and loose use limitations that we started talking about earlier. Has to identify all the holders, and it must be signed by the environmental agency as well as every owner of the fee simple.
Senator Higgins.
That was my question. What's a fee simple?
That's the title you hope you have in your property.
Why don't we call it a title?
Because that's just what's been called for 500 years.
Okay. Well,
well, in regular people term, Mr. Hainsworth, a fee simple is really everything that you own.
I mean, you own that means you own it.
You own it
with nobody else having claiming a third party can't claim any interest in it, like a leasehold interest or anything like that.
Right. Please continue, Ms. Timmons.
Okay, and Professor Hainsworth noted that on the amendment, there on page 3, line 7, part of what the amendment would do, and this I believe was requested by Mr. Williams, is to clarify that when the environmental agency is a federal agency, the covenant must also be approved and signed by the state environmental agency that has authority. So that helps protect us in the state by having our state agency involved as well. Let's see. Okay, the contents I've talked about. Section 5 on page 4 of the bill talks about the validity of an environmental covenant. This is very important in real estate terms because, especially in many states, these covenants are not perpetual and they are not valid. And so this is an important section that establishes the validity of these covenants under real estate law. Section 6 relates to the relationship to other land use laws. Basically, what it's trying to say here is that zoning, for example, is not affected, except to the extent that the activity or use limitation would be paramount, but that other land use law is going to continue in effect unless there's a direct conflict with something in the covenant. Section 7 goes into the notice that's required in terms of proposed environmental covenants, with notice having to go to and any amendments, then any proposed amendments, the notice has to go to these parties too, and it's really everybody who signed the covenant and everybody who has an interest in the matter. Section 8 requires that these covenants be recorded, so that they are recorded in the land records and can be found again, since they are perpetual unless they're terminated. That is essentially what Section 9 says, that they're perpetual unless it's terminated by consent of the parties who originally went into the matter. Or there are some possibilities of terminating or modifying the covenant either by administrative action, which is consistent with our existing Minnesota law, or by a court under the doctrine of changed circumstances. Because we know that sometimes new technologies might be invented, maybe an environmental problem can be dealt with in a different way. So there do need to be some ways to modify these things, but there are limited ways that are proposed, that are recited in the law with specific procedures and specific notice to the parties involved. The Section 10 goes into more detail on the amendment or termination by consent. Section 11 provides who can enforce an environmental covenant, and it can be any party to the covenant, including all holders, because there may actually be more than one holder. And the amendment that's before you has been again proposed by the agency, because what this does is it makes it clear that the state environmental agency that signed the covenant may use any remedy or enforcement measures that are already existent in Minnesota law. And so that is made clear, that this act does not intend to supplant that, those other enforcement powers. And then I guess the rest of them, I believe, are pretty much, 14. I guess 14 is substantive recovery of litigation costs, and so forth, that really refers back to the administrative law provisions that are already existent in Minnesota, and to the extent we're adding a new administrative procedure here, the cost of litigation provisions would be determined the same as any other administrative law case. Okay, and Section 15, I guess, is also noteworthy in that one of the things the uniform law did not go into, because this is not handled uniformly across the states, is we did not go into eminent domain, adding nationally any powers of creating an environmental covenant by eminent domain. However, that power already exists in Minnesota law. So what we simply did here is we amended the provision of Minnesota law that already permits that, and references this new Chapter 114E dealing with environmental covenants, as opposed to the old references to the to easements and so forth.
Ms. Timmons, I think that it would be important to provide to the members in the committee sort of a context for the need for this.
Mm-hmm.
Is it you or is it Ms. Hainsworth? Can somebody talk about the rationale behind the emergence of the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, and really it being a response to kind of risk-based cleanup or reuse of brownfields property?
Yes, Madam Chair and members, that's exactly right. It was in part a response to the use of these risk-based cleanups, and maybe more specifically, the desire to try to give uniform rules across the states to be able to create these and enforce these and be able to discover these, in terms of having them always recorded, for example. It was actually, the committee was funded in part by a grant from the Federal Department of Defense. Why, you might ask? Because the Federal Department of Defense is the owner of a whole bunch of contaminated properties all over the country, one of which I dealt with when I was in the Ramsey County Attorney's Office, that Army Arsenal site up in New Brighton, Shoreview, up in northern Ramsey County. So one of their interests was to have more uniform rules for creating environmental covenants across the country to help them facilitate the cleanup and resale and reuse of federal properties, for example, that were no longer needed for, you know, for Department of Defense sites. Similarly, a lot of our advisors and people interested in this were national or international corporations. General Electric, for example, had a council there. Very similar concern as what I just explained for the Department of Defense. They have many properties across the country, all kinds of different rules. I'm sure companies in Minnesota, like 3M, have properties probably all over the country in addition to the ones in Minnesota that we've been reading about. So I think that was part of the impetus to try to create a more uniform way to deal with these risk-based cleanups and brownfields across the country, and to do it through a uniform state law that the states could consider. And I might say, I did look up before I came here today, 15 states have adopted the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, plus the U.S. Virgin Islands. And there are probably about a dozen introductions in 2007 in various other states.
Ms. Timmons, or anybody else on the panel, let me ask you this question then. The covenant only comes into place at a point when the property is going to transfer ownership or transfer hands, or as a certain piece of property is being contemplated for a different kind of reuse.
It would apply to both the sale and the reuse. Somebody owning the property and wanting to use it for some purpose couldn't use it for that unless they got one of these covenants if it is a contaminated piece of property. So it's not just the transfer, it's also the current owner of the property.
So, Mr. Hainsworth, if the city of St. Paul wants to go into a PDQ site to maybe take ownership and redevelop that, and they know for a fact that there's contaminants in there, at that point, the city of St. Paul would then engage with PDQ site in that redevelopment process, or if PDQ themselves would like to redevelop that, which is a manufacturing site, into a different use, they would then trigger that process.
They have to trigger the process of having the Pollution Control Authority go in and look at it and see if it could be used for anything. And then if they determine that it could be used with remediation, could be used for certain purposes, then they could agree to that, and that's how you get into one of these environmental covenants. Then you'd enter into that, and that becomes binding on the development of that property, whoever owns it, and whoever owns it forever until it's released.
Only for that specific kinds of use or within a certain limited amount of use.
It could be either or. It could be for certain types of uses or only for a specific use, or it could be that certain action has to be taken before you can even use it for that purpose. And this doesn't allow you to get around any of the other regulations. For example, if there are zoning laws that are there, and the zoning laws wouldn't allow it to be used for a use that would be permissible by PCA, well, then it still couldn't. You don't get around your zoning rules or your other kinds of use limitations simply by getting an environmental covenant.
So, Mr. Hainsworth, in that instance where the landowner redevelops their own land for a different purpose, the covenant then would be between the Pollution Control Agency and the landowner?
That would be part of it. It depends on who else might be involved in it. And that would be on the title. It'd be in the what they call the chain of title of the property. So anybody buying or getting an interest in the property would see that on the record.
So 25 years down the road, I want to buy that property. Then the landowner, I would have notice.
Yes.
If there was presumably the covenant that would be recorded.
That's correct.
In the title.
That's correct.
And so when I go to buy from the owner, and let's say maybe it isn't 25 years, maybe it's 100 years down the road, and all people involved in this transaction are long gone, and I go in and we do a title search, and that emerges, then that would give me notice that it could only be used for that specific use?
Yes. Now, you could bring an action, or somebody could bring an action to, and you could go to the PCA and say, we want to get a release that, you know, this no longer applies, it shouldn't apply, et cetera. The use is not, that we're proposing is not incompatible. We want to get a release of it. And then you could do that. And if they refuse to do it, to consent to it, and you have to give notice to everybody that could have an interest in the property. And if they refuse, then you could bring an action in court to get it to get it released, or to get some modification of it. But, of course, PCA would be a party to that action.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hainsworth, how would this relate to our laws about Superfund sites?
I think I would leave that up to Mr. Williams to describe.
Yes,
that.
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Alan Williams, Assistant Attorney General. I represent the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. I'd like to make one general comment before I answer Senator Higgins' question, and that is that the Pollution Control Agency is not promoting this bill, but is okay with this bill. The Pollution Control Agency has had a chance to review it quite thoroughly. We've worked quite well, and the representatives of the Uniform Law Commission have been very cooperative, and so the bill is in the shape that PCA can live with. But the PCA is not actively promoting the bill. I would direct your attention really to the definitional section of the bill for the answer to this question. Page 1, starting on line 122, the definition of environmental response project. An environmental covenant has to be related to an environmental response project. And an environmental response project would be approved by an environmental agency, also as defined in the statute. And so one of the kinds of projects that you will see here on line 2.3 is there's a reference to Chapter 115B. Chapter 115B is the state Superfund law. So, but there are, of course, there are other programs. The petroleum tank law is referenced here, and other types of environmental laws.
So, Mr. Williams, how does the meth lab house that Senator Higgins was talking about, something has to happen to trigger it to make it an environmental response project?
Environmental cleanup, I assume.
Madam Chair, I'm not really familiar with the number of occasions where meth labs have been cleaned up using environmental authorities. I believe it has happened. I can't cite you a specific example, but the cleanup or the response action would have to come under one of the laws that's specifically mentioned in the definition that I pointed out.
So, Mr. Williams or Mr. Hainsworth, this wouldn't be contemplated for private person selling to a private person. It's usually a pretty big project.
Madam Chair, it could apply to an individual selling to another individual who wants to use the property. They've got to have a right to use it for whatever purpose they intend to use it.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of back up a minute to the reason, I think that was alluded to, but the reason for this legislation, under existing law, and this is not my field, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but under existing law, we have, once something's been identified, a piece of property has been identified as contaminated, and without this, would the owner of that property, whether it's the government or a large company, be prevented from selling or transferring ownership of the property? No?
Alan, you need to...
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, there would be no prohibition on the sale of the property, and this bill doesn't impose any prohibition on the sale of the property either. What this bill does is it allows the environmental agency, as part of approving a cleanup, to require that the owner record one of these covenants so that when that property changes hands, the new owner will be aware of the restrictions on the property and will be bound by those restrictions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there's nothing about this legislation that would somehow make it easier for a polluter to avoid or stretch out the time period that this cleanup would have to occur within. This isn't going to make it take some of the impetus away from doing that kind of cleanup, in your opinion?
Mr. Williams.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, this bill doesn't change any of the standards that the agency would apply in terms of approving a cleanup. I hope that answers your question.
But, Mr. Williams, what this bill does do, though, is to say that if I purchase a piece of property from Senator Olson, and there was a covenant attached to it saying that it could only be used for a parking lot, and I turned around and I built some houses on it, and then some of the people who live in those houses become very ill as a result of that, doesn't it create a point to come back to in terms of the liability?
Madam Chair, you're asking actually a quite complicated question. The owner who would take such action, I think, would certainly be exposing themselves to potential liability to the people who are harmed. What this bill is doing is allowing the agency, whatever environmental agency has approved the covenant and approved that cleanup that left the property restricted to a parking lot use, to bring an enforcement action to go to court and prevent that owner from removing the parking lot and using it for some other purpose. With the amendment that was added, the agency would have the additional authority to use civil penalties or some of the other authorities that it has in other environmental enforcement situations. So that's how it's intended to work.
But in that instance, though, Senator Olson in some way is protected, isn't she? I mean, the people who are ill from the secondary use of the property, I mean, they can come after me because I didn't pay attention to the covenant that came with it, and I used it inappropriately for a different purpose. Don't I, by purchasing that land under that covenant, that knowingly that it could only be used for parking lot, don't I then sort of alleviate or sort of make Senator Olson's obligation go away so the people who are living in those homes who are ill, because Senator Olson is the one who created the contamination. But I bought it from her saying that.
Everyone's picking on me today.
I mean, does that make her obligations go away?
If she...
Madam Chair, that's also a somewhat complicated question. I would say that the party who disturbed the property in violation of the covenant and thereby caused the injury is going to be the party that's going to be looked to primarily for liability. Would it be possible that a party who had a prior involvement with creating the contamination could also incur some liability? I wouldn't want to rule that out.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I don't know who would know the answer to this. When there's a covenant put on the land, does a local unit of government get notified that there is a covenant attached
yes.
to that?
Yes.
So that in circumstances like the one that Senator Mwah just said, maybe when the new owner went to go get building permits or mm-hmm. something else, there would be a note on the property that so that you can only use this property for certain things.
Ms. Timmons?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, members, that is in the bill. It's on page 6. It's part of that notice provision. So a copy of an environmental covenant and any amendments or any notices of termination must be provided to, and then on 6.4 and 5, each political subdivision in which real property subject to the covenant is located. So, yes, the local governments would get notice of that.
Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just so I'm crystal clear, and I don't mean to belabor this point, but you raised this issue when you said something about the government wanting to sell lands that, you know, and that was part of the reasons they had initiated this act to begin with. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in this bill that would in any way prevent the original polluter from being held liable for the cleanup costs or that would slow down the requirement that they engage in that type of cleanup. This isn't a substitute for that,
no.
then?
No.
Okay.
It is,
Ms. Timmons.
It is not, Madam Chair, Senator Olson and members. The committee, the drafting committee, very specifically stayed away from the issue of liability. I mean, we know that that's been a very difficult issue and it's very complex, as Mr. Williams stated. But for that reason, we stayed away from that. There are no liability sections in this law. We don't believe that it creates any greater liability, nor does it take away any liability from on the part of responsible parties for original pollution. So that's not the intent here. The intent here is just to create a tool to have a uniform way of creating an environment
environmental covenant when the parties involved, including the state agency responsible for the environment, agrees such a covenant is a good thing.
So under current law, mm-hmm. if we don't have this in place, mm-hmm. Don't people already have some kind of notice anyways? Ms. Timmons?
Yes, there is the opportunity. There is about one line in the statutes that allows the Pollution Control Agency, for example, to create these covenants now. So under Minnesota law, we already have many of these covenants, and Mr. Williams can speak with more authority to that point. What this does is it really fleshes it out. It requires that the covenant must be recorded. Some of the notice provisions that we talked about, for example, to the local governmental entities are included in this law. It gives a lot more structure and detail.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Williams.
Ms. Timmons is correct that there is authority currently, and there has been authority for some years, for the state Superfund program to use environmental covenants, and they do. And that authority is in Section 15, which is amended on the last page of the bill. So there is quite a bit of experience in Minnesota with environmental covenants, and that actually was one of the reasons why the Pollution Control Agency was so interested in working with this bill, was we wanted to make sure that this bill was consistent with agency practice, mm-hmm. and I think that we have accomplished that with the amendments that have been made. But there are other environmental programs besides the State Superfund program that will be able to use these covenants.
Very good. Any other questions for any of the testifiers?
Move the bill.
Senator Foley moves that Senate file 1051, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? Anybody here testifying against or for this bill in the audience that would like to testify? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion passes. Now, when this gets to the floor, I have to explain this bill. We may be visiting.
And the revisers staff can come.